So it's, so it's starting time, I guess. Okay.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Yeah, we'll go ahead and kick in then. Okay. Because I never know. I got three clocks in here, and they all say different times. So we're going to assume it's start time. How's that? Okay. All right. I'm going to modify this a little bit, hopefully to kind of connect with you guys where you are. So this is after the trip, getting the most out of your short-term mission through debriefing. So what this is all about, come on in. You missed one line. That was it. Okay. So getting the most out of debriefing. I want to give you a little bit of kind of a background of history of what's going on in short-term missions in the USA, kind of what that means for a lot of different people out there, and then what I think should be happening that's not happening. So that's kind of where we're going. So, hey, come on in. And, okay, basically where I'm coming from, and I took the slide off that said who I am because typically there's introductions on these things, but there's no introduction today. So basically I'm Gary Green. It's my wife Frances who just came in. And we lived in Costa Rica for a year, 1990. Then after that, went to Harding Grad School and re-equipped my life for long-term missions. Because previously I was a veterinarian. I don't know what majors you guys are, but I was undergrad animal science. And then I went to LSU School of Veterinary Medicine, practiced medicine for a few years in Baton Rouge. We felt the call to missions, so we went to Costa Rica to learn Spanish, and then after that, Harding Grad School to re-equip for missions, and then moved on to Venezuela and did long-term church planting in Venezuela for about 8 years before coming here. When we came to ACU, one of the things we discovered was there was no door for students to get involved in missions. If you want to be involved in missions, basically you just had to kind of know somebody. Come on in, guys. So the history here at ACU for missions was simply if you wanted, as a student, to get involved, you kind of had to know the right person. You had to know Galen Van Rienen, who was here at the time. You had to know Ed Matthews or some of the guys. And then through them, say, who do you know on the field? And they would say, well, I've got a buddy. I'll call him. We'll see how this works out. There was no like front door where you could go and get involved. And so another guy named Wyman Walker, who's now running a study abroad down in Montevideo, Wyman and I partnered together and established Worldwide Witness here on campus. And basically, we had our first interns in 2002, and since then we've had 734 ACU students go overseas. It's a two-month internship because we find that most of you guys, when you go through high school nowadays, very often are out of the country. How about you guys? How many of you guys went out of the country with your high school youth group? Okay, a couple, all right. But what we've discovered was that when people come here, they have a very different expectation of what short-term missions means. It usually means like a 1 week or 10-day trip with 30 people, and there's a set schedule, and you just kind of all go and do this big thing. So it gets a big mob kind of moving around. Come on in. So when most of our students come, short-term missions to most of our students means huge group of people, 1 week, youth group, go somewhere together. So we established this program here at ACU in order to push people a little bit and stretch our students. And so basically through Worldwide Witness, we try to put you in groups of twos and threes, and we send you overseas to live either with local people or missionaries. Hey, come on in. So through the program, last year we had the privilege of getting what's called SOE, Standard of Excellence Recognition. It's good to see you. I was thinking, wait a minute, I hadn't seen his face in a couple of years. You all right? Good. Last year we received what's called a Standard of Excellence. We're the only Church of Christ organization in the United States to have received the World Evangelical Alliance Seal of Approval. That's what that means. It's the Standard of Excellence Approval. You have to meet certain standards and do certain things, and so it's been pretty neat that we've gotten to that level to be recognized now by the World Evangelical Alliance. So that's where I'm coming from when I think about short-term missions and what's going on. I experienced about 730 students. My other job here at ACU is I'm the Associate Director for Missions at ACU, and so also work with organizing long-term church teams. We've trained 14 long-term teams. That's a five-year commitment minimum. We trained 14 of those and sent them out in the last 7 years. We have two more in training right now. So, short-term missions, all right? This is what happens when you wind up talking to an animal science veterinarian turned missionary. Okay, you get chicken examples, all right? So, just starting with this, you got to sit on the left side. I mean, you know, just one off that, okay. I'm just messing with you, okay? She's in my Old Testament class, so. Assumptions. Assumptions get you into trouble. So here's my vet med mission connection to explain how assumptions get you into trouble. Because short-term missions, in many, many, many ways, is based upon a group of assumptions within churches. So, years ago I was an undergraduate and I heard in animal science class that all birds have one functioning ovary instead of two. And that basically all the eggs that a bird will ever lay come from the one functioning ovary. And I thought, there's no way. Hey, Karen, come on in. And so, there's no way, okay? So, my friend and I hear this one functioning ovary is all that birds have, and we think that's ridiculous. We research it, says, yeah, that's right. But research also is saying that if something happens to a bird when it's very, very, very young, then the other ovary can kick in and develop, and sometimes it will develop as what's called an oval testes, so it becomes a male organ and therefore produces testosterone and changes the sex of the bird. And we thought, that's bizarre, you know, that God would let that happen in nature. That's kind of wacky. And so we decided, let's run an experiment and see what happens. So we talked to ConAgra. We get some little bitty birds donated. We get some older chickens. We have our control groups. We do surgery to damage the functioning ovary of the younger ones and to give us some time and see what happens. Now, as time rolls around, in order to kind of check this and see, did the other ovary kick in, now we have to post the birds, okay? Which is a nice way of saying you got to kill them and you got to check out and see if that other ovary developed into something. So, time to go kill a whole bunch of birds. Now, if I was raised, out in the country, and plucking chickens is just a pain. You know, it gets all over you and it's just messy. So, hey, my buddy and I had this great idea. Feathers are made out of protein. Protein burns. If you add a little gasoline to the protein, it burns even faster. So let's burn the feathers off. These are dead chickens. Let's burn the feathers off of the chickens, and that'll be real fast and quick and easy. So we got all these chickens to do, and we won't have to get all these feathers all over us. So, to take proper precaution, we go down to this small lake behind his house, tie a nylon cord to the foot of this dead chicken, and kind of ruffle his feathers up and pour a little gasoline on the feathers. Reach down and feel of it, and it's like, wow, that just ran right off. It didn't do much good. So ruffle the feathers some more, put a little more gasoline on them, kind of rub it in, light the chicken. And I mean, it was impressive. Just this big ball of flames is going, and we're kind of trying to stand back here and see in there and holding the rope. And I'm shouting now, and he's shouting, not yet, not yet, not yet. And eventually he goes, okay, throw it in the water. That's how we're going to put the flame out, right? Well, you know, I about threw my arm off because it's a nylon cord that we have, and nylon burns. And so I had about this much rope in my hand, didn't know it, you know, because the whole thing had burned all the way up. There's a chicken. We panic, all right? Two rednecks panicking, so we just kind of drop back and punt the bird into the water. Now, this is when we realize water doesn't put out a gasoline fire, right? And so now we have this oil slick burning, floating away from us on top of the lake. To which my partner responds, Gary, I can't swim. You got to jump in and get the bird. To which I respond, I can't swim either. And so we run down to get this little dinghy boat on there, and the little dinghy boat on the shore has a hole in it, plus there's a snake under it. And so we left it, and then we came back, and now we figured the only way to get this bird back is to reverse the current. So we get down on our hands and knees, and we start paddling, and eventually we get enough of a current where the bird starts floating back our direction. It gets almost to us, and we get excited, and we start flipping the water up onto it, which turns the current around, and the bird starts leaving. Ah! So we get down, we start paddling, and get the bird back to us. And when the bird finally gets up to the shore, we flip on the water from the side, smother out the flames, grab the bird, pick it up out of the water, which is, you know, about 500 degrees in temperature. We forgot about that part. Burns our hands, so we throw it, and it lands in the puddle of gasoline. Oh, my gosh, panic. Kick the bird back in the water. Oh, no, here we go again. Okay, this was like the dumbest thing that you could imagine. Two rednecks. I mean, now, honestly, this is about 5 miles down the road from where the Duck Dynasty guys live. Okay, I mean, so we contributed our share to... This is what rednecks look like trying to figure out how to burn feathers, okay? It was terrible. The one consolation was my partner looks at me and says, well, at least no one else saw this. And we turned around and looked up the hill, and there stood his wife with this look on her face of, oh my gosh. And she just turned and walked off and left us, you know? So, okay, I set that up just to say... If you make a lot of assumptions, sometimes you can get yourself in a lot of trouble without realizing it, right? You expect things to happen, and it just doesn't flow that way. And I think that's a lot of what's going on in short-term missions. We expect certain things to happen with short-term missions, right? All right, you fill in the blank for me, the field of dreams idea. You know, if you build it, they will come. Short-term missions, what would you say? If you send people in short-term missions, how are they going to be changed? What do you expect people to be like when they come back? What would be some of those things? Got to interact with you guys so you don't go to sleep. This is a cold room, and you'll freeze to death if you don't talk. So what do you think happens to people in short-term missions? What would be some of the expected outcomes? Do what?
I'll have a good, greater perspective.
Okay, bigger worldview, right? Okay, increase your worldview. What else? You three guys, help me out here. Just let me sit in the front. I know you're up front, close. What do you think people, how would you expect people to change?
Realize what they have. Or what they, you know.
Be more grateful for what they have, right? Less materialistic, good. What else?
I think it would depend on what happened on the trip. If it was a, go build homes, then
uh-huh.
Be more of a world perspective thing. But if they go and really interact with the native people, and if they see healings and stuff like that, that can affect them in a more spiritual
right way. So we're expecting spiritual change, right? So when you talk to people about what do you expect and what do you assume is going to happen on a short-term mission trip, you get a list of answers that kind of vary like this. Okay, people say, okay, if you go on a short-term mission, expect people to come back and pray more. Expect them to be more giving, okay? They recognize how good they have it. They recognize how much they've been blessed. People are anticipated to participate more in church activities and participate more in small groups. Evangelism, right? Okay, they've been affected spiritually. Expect them to share their faith a little bit more. To be signing up for more missions, to be more inclined to go into long-term missions, and a bunch of other stuff. And matter of fact, if you talk to missionaries, this was these two guys got together, interviewed a lot of short-term workers and a lot of long-term workers, okay, short-term mission, long-term mission. They came up with a list of 32 anticipated results and published it, okay? So talk to short-term missionaries, long-term missionaries. We think there's going to be all these mutual beneficial things going on, all right? So if I talk to my students when they come back, and I say, how did it go with you? I get these kind of answers. These are things that Worldwide Witness students have said. These are all Worldwide Witness photos. This is one of my favorite ones. I woke up to new priorities. Okay, spoken by a young lady that went on two different trips and was dedicating her life to long-term missions and now works in Nashville. Okay, and that's kind of a common thing. Matter of fact, most of these quotes, I think, can be traced to people who have gone on to jobs in business and other kind of things. It looks a little bit different. So, in the short-term mission world, one day something went bump, okay? The great cat in the hat. Something went bump and kind of made us all wake up a little bit lately. You see, if you look at qualitative studies, now what a qualitative study is, you guys are going on a short-term mission trip and you come back and I give you a questionnaire and I say, have you been affected and will you give more? Will you participate more? That big list of things, will you go more? Will you sign up for another short-term mission trip? Or do you pray more now? Everybody says yes to all that stuff. It's kind of what's called the halo effect. If I'm asking Karen, Karen, do you have a good experience Sunday at church? Now, 9 out of 10 times, if I'm the minister and she's a member, she knows that I'm looking for the yes answer, right? And so she's going to say what I want to hear. And typically that's what happens when people self-report on short-term missions. They're going to tell you what you want to hear. They're going to give you the skewed answer, yes, I pray more, yes, I evangelize more. And most people actually believe that, but when you self-report, it's hard to be very critical. So, just a couple years ago, this guy named Kurt Verbeek grabbed all the studies that he could find, pulled them all together, and he threw out the qualitative studies, okay? Qualitative studies just being, were you changed? And people say, yes. That's about as scientific as saying, are you hot or cold? Yeah, I'm cold. Okay, yeah. Scientifically, we've proven that it's cold. Right? So he got rid of the qualitative studies where people just had one question and answered and there was nothing else going on. And so he went and found the quantitative studies that have been conducted. Now, a quantitative study has one of three characteristics. One, it has a control group. Okay? And as a veterinarian, I can tell you that most of the studies done previously on short-term missions would never have made it to the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association or the Journal of the American Medical Association. They're so poorly constructed. So go and look for good studies, which is what Verbeek did. And he said, okay, you have to have something that has a control group. and then the actual group that you're measuring. Okay, that's just classic medical scientific study. Or if you don't have a control group, you do a longitudinal study. So we'll give you the questionnaire before you go, we'll give you the questionnaire when you come back, and we'll give it to you another year down the road. Or you do a triangulation study. Triangulation study is where you can actually measure data from another source. For example, one of the interesting studies on short-term missions was from a short-term group. They went from one group to say, we've got some very Southern Hills members, so if Southern Hills were to send 30 people overseas this summer and they come back and the questionnaire has to do with your giving to missions, then you could go get the Southern Hills church budget if they had a breakout for missions and compare the two and see, did these people really give more? Okay, did the church contribution go up? Okay, so that's a triangulation study. So control group or long-term longitudinal series study or the ability to triangulate. Now, when Verbeek looked at all of those studies, only two studies out of 13 showed any form of variation of increased change over time. 11 out of 13 said no significant change. Another guy, Scott Moreau, who just stepped down as the president of Missio Nexus Organization, which is the largest mission organization in the world, reviewed the data. He said, to date, no direct correlation can be drawn between the massive increase in short-term missions and long-term sending. Anybody have a guess at how much money gets spent in short-term missions in the United States per year? What would your guess be? Okay, think of flights. Think of time on the field, stays on the field. Go ahead.
Is it millions? Tens of millions? Higher.
It's estimated that as much as $2 billion with a B per year. You tend to think if we're dumping $2 billion per year into short-term missions, you're going to see some kind of a bleb of an increase in long-term missionaries. No. There is no increase in long-term missions from short-term missions in the United States of America. Okay. In fact, one study has been conducted that is actually proposing the theory that we might actually be inoculating people against long-term missions. Right? So think medicine again. If I give you little doses of something on a routine basis, then eventually you're going to build up resistance to it and not be affected by it down the road. If you take three short-term mission trips, eventually you think that's all there is to missions, so why in the world do I need to do this? I've already checked it, done it, go on to something else. And so people actually lose interest in long-term mission. One study actually indicated that over a three-year period, some people actually participate less in church and give less after participating in short-term missions. Okay, so we might actually be going the wrong way through short-term missions if we don't do it right. Okay. Not happy stuff so far, right? Okay, it's not like, oh yeah, I'm not a short-term mission go guy. I'm a short-term mission do it right guy. And I don't think we're doing it right yet in some ways. Okay, so if you look at all the research, everything is indicating poor return on the dollar for what we're doing in short-term missions. Karen, yeah.
I have a question. Is it all age groups?
All age groups, yes. And most studies are done on younger people just because that's the bulk. But yeah, those 13 quantitative studies and the other qualitative, that was all age groups. Yeah. So, why? Why are short-term missions not affecting people personally and changing them? And why are they not then translating into long-term missions like they should? Okay, it's got to be one of three things. It's either got to be what's going on before they go, very poor training. I'm going to say I don't think that's it, because if you go online, you can find lots of good study training aids. You can find DVD series now that are helpful and helping people get prepared. Entire books written on it. Courses are available. There's a lot of really good training stuff. And when I talk to most short-term missions, there is some form of short-term preparation going on before people go. So I think there's a lot of effort being put in on that end. There's tons of literature out there. Okay, is it that while people are on the field, they're having a negative experience, and therefore you don't get the changes? Well, all of those qualitative studies, no one says they have bad experiences. Very, very, very few people say they have a bad experience. Now, some people lie, okay? I get that. I've had that happen in our experience here at ACU. We had one student that eventually had a bad experience. We talked to him about it, and so I thought, well, that's kind of odd. So I went and looked up the students who went to the same place the year before, and I said, yeah, that kind of happened to me too. Really? Well, why don't you say something? Well, I don't want to mess it up for the next guy. So I went back another year, and I found those guys who were now not at ACU, and they were living somewhere else. And I said, did this happen to you? He goes, yeah. I said, why don't you say anything? Well, I don't want to mess it up for the next guy. He's like, well, thank you very much. Now we've got, you know, 3 years worth of mess ups here. You could have said something, but that's not the norm, okay? Every now and then that happens. But it's not the norm. Most people that go on a short-term mission trip, in your experience, you can say, hey, they've been wonderful times. I talked to several of you before you came in, know a lot of you. These typically are good experiences. So, afterwards, what happens? Now, what we found out from looking around is that most people do nothing afterwards. People fly back, they get off the plane, they go to work. They fly back, and typically by the time they get out of the airport, all of our students are on the cell phones and texting and catching up on Facebook, and boom, they shift gears and don't think about what they just did. So, I went out and started looking on the web. What do you find related to short-term missions? I'm going to catch us up a little bit. If you do a little bit of testing, a little bit of research on the web, what you're going to find is a lot of people saying you should debrief. Okay? Everybody says that. Yes! You need to debrief people and have time together when you come back. And then you find absolutely nothing about how to do that. Zilch. It's just almost nothing out there. It's just amazing. Matter of fact, this was a study by Catherine Tuttle looking at how college students were affected in their spiritual maturity. And in this study, she actually says those who received good or excellent debriefing were better able to process their experiences. But then she doesn't tell you what that means. She doesn't define good or excellent debriefing. She just says they had it and then went on with it. So, if you continue searching on the web, you can find lists of questions. This is the most common thing. These are three examples, and there's a lot of them. You can find lists. Oh, hey, when people come back, you ought to ask them these six things, these eight things, these 10 things, and help them process a little bit. Okay, that's typically the main thing you can find. Ronald Kotesky has written a little short-term PDF file you get online. It's about 5 pages long. That's probably about the longest thing you can find online for how to debrief short-term interns. Basically, everybody says do it, but then no one tells you how to do it. So, hold that thought for 1 second. Here's what we've been doing here at ACU. We started our program in 2002, and basically, we were working so hard just to get people to sign up and go on the program that people had gone. And before they came back, my partner looks at me one day and goes, we ought to do something with them when they come back. So, yeah, we ought to do something with them. I have no idea what. And so he and I got online and began to look at debriefing, and we had to go look at, you know, police debriefing and fireman debriefing and emergency worker debriefings and come up with ideas. And so when all of our students came back, we said Sunday before school starts, everybody show up over here at Mentor Lane Church. And we did the classic thing. We bribed with food. Okay, you know, we're going to serve you a meal. And Wyman had his ice cream maker over there going, you know, this is going to be a great thing. Well, for 4 years in a row, we had a maximum compliance rate of 30%. So we send 50 students, well, we send, you know, 30 students overseas and get 20. We sent 60 students overseas and we get 20 people. Okay, I stay away from math. Francis helps my sons with math all the time, you know. So we never got more than 30% of our students to come on any given Sunday. They were too busy already engaged in other stuff. So we tweaked it. 2007, 2009, instead of just having big group gatherings, we said, hey, come, we're going to have these big group debriefing times, but also we pulled in enough people that they're going to help you have individual conversations and process what you've done. Okay? Result was 30%. Never got more than that. So from 2002 to 2009, we never got more than 30% of our students to come back. And I guarantee you, in any church where you're going to have doctors, lawyers, mechanics, business owners going overseas, you're going to have the same issue. To get them to sit down and talk after they come back is very, very hard to do. So, something changed again for us. In 2009, ACU allowed us to take our training, our pre-field training, and make it into a class. Okay, so this is very sneaky how we got to kind of torpedo students from the side without them knowing it here. So, 2009, they let us make it into a class. Therefore, we said, okay, we're going to give you an incomplete passing at the end of the spring class. You go do your internship, and when you come back, we're going to place 200 points on your debriefing. So in other words, you can drop from an A to a C if you do not debrief with us. The result, almost 100% compliance. It's been really cool the last few years. Everybody comes in. That's pretty neat. Here's what we do when they do come in. We have multiple stages, okay? Everybody goes through a questionnaire, helps us know, is it a good experience? What do we need to be doing? How do we need to be tweaking this for the next year? Everyone takes what's called the Cerny-Smith assessment. The CSA is the one that is probably the number one cross-cultural stress assessor on the field. So every student of ours that comes back takes this stress assessment, and it allows us to see, did they really have major issues? Are they hiding things? And it breaks down those issues into 13 different categories. And so we see a sliding scale on 13 different areas of their life, how they were affected by the short-term mission. Because some students will tell you straight up, I had a great experience, but then when they have to fill out something about stress that probes a little bit different, you can find what it was on this trip that caused them issues and deal with that so that then the whole thing gets interpreted differently. We have a face-to-face conversation. Every student's required to come in and visit with my partner and me. We finished this up last week. It takes quite a while to interview 70 different students, but we finally finished it last week. And then, a few years ago, 4 years ago, we wrote a manuscript and said, we want you to read this and answer some questions off of it. Again, just to get them to slow down and think. After doing that twice with our students, we got feedback, kept tweaking it, and now have put it out in a book. Now, here's what's kind of sad about this, okay? I'm excited about this book. So I wrote this, Now What? Spiritual Discernment for Culture Encounters. I'm super excited about this. I think this is the best thing since instant grits. You know, being a country boy, love my grits. Okay, so I think this is awesome. This is the only book in the world in print on how to spiritually debrief a mission trip. Now that is sad, but that's it. Okay, that is the only book in print on how to spiritually debrief an internship. Isn't that amazing? So here's kind of what it breaks down like. Here's what we've done with this, and we're trying to get more and more people to buy into picking up a copy and using it. This is our attempt to slow people down. Okay, it's not that huge. It's only 80 pages, but the format is designed to slow our students down. Chapter 1 is just an introduction, and chapter 2 of this thing is where we get feedback that I didn't expect. Because what happens is the way that you interpret your life experiences depends upon your understanding of the will of God. Now, there's three different ways to view this, and I'm going to hit these really fast so we have some time for questions. Most ACU students would not admit this, but I'm going to say probably 90% of ACU students view the will of God this way. Okay? And this isn't based just upon my looking around. There's a lot out there you can find on it. Basically, if you view the will of God like a bullseye, most of our students view that God has a personal plan for me, and this is it, and it's set. Okay? And if I don't hit the bullseye every time and go from step to step hitting the bullseye, I can get off of the will of God and train wreck my life. Okay? That produces a boatload of anxiety and fear because, oh my gosh, how do I interpret what just happened? Okay, I'm walking down the street. This guy comes up and says X to me. Is that a sign from God? And if it is, then all of a sudden that trumps every promise I've ever made to anybody. You know, that whole let your yes be yes, no be no thing. That is the most underused, non-influential verse for the millennial generation. Okay, it means nothing. Because the millennial generation trumps that verse with, but God told me. Right? And if I miss God's will, then can I ever get back to it? It is a terrifying place to be, and it's where a lot of our students live on a 24/7 basis. And so when they go overseas, they have a great experience. Oh my goodness, does this mean I need to drop out of school and move over here next week? And we have that over and over and over. So is that the proper way to interpret God's will? Or do I interpret God's will through what's called the ditch model? That was called the dot theory. The ditch model basically is that if I just keep it between the ditches morally, okay, over here's the ditch of having sex with my neighbor's wife, not a good thing. Lying to the president, not a good thing. Stealing from my neighbor, not a good thing. Well, if I can avoid those ditches, God lets me do anything else. It's basically almost an uninvolved God. He's only concerned with morality, and this is really, some people use this, but not frequently within our society. I propose the dad model. This is me with some of my kids. And basically, the definition of this, the father guides us through life and wants us to develop the gifts he's given us into something that honors him. My youngest son, Lucas here, wearing his nice Drew Brees Louisiana shirt. My youngest son right now is applying to universities. I really do not care where he goes. I really do not care what he studies, as long as he makes a choice that develops the giftedness within him in a way that he can grow to potential and honor God with it. He's looking at everything from forestry to photography to law. He's sitting up really high in his class. He can do any of those. I don't care which one he does. I just want to have a relation with him throughout his life, and I want him to honor God with whatever use of those gifts he develops. And I think that's the way God looks at us. So we try to help students think through, how do you interpret the will of God? I'm going to zip through this and just kind of walk you through. The three chapters after that deal with, how did you see God? How did you see others? How did you see yourself on this trip? There'll be a section that you read about it, and after about four or five pages of story and reading, we'll have reflection questions. So there's a place here for each person to write in. For example, do you see God through your recent experiences? Don't worry about comparing your moments with those of others. This is about you and God. Did you see him in adversity, victory, the lives of others? Write down the numerous events. There might only be one, but go ahead and write out what happened. And then we have them process that and distill it so that the last question says, write one short and clear sentence that explains what you learned about God. We do that with God, others, and self. And then we have a whole section here that's based upon Ignatian concepts. Ignatius of Loyola was a guy who believed that when you feel something deep moving within you, that is God speaking to you. And so we have three chapters of looking back, and then we use some Ignatian concepts to look forward. So what does this experience mean when I look down the road? How do I apply it? And we talk about community discernment. We talk about going back to Scripture. We talk about who you can sit down and visit with and talk with and pray with. Okay, so we look backwards and then we look forward. So where are we? What's been the results here at the work that we do at ACU? For our first 10 years, if we look back with the debriefing we had, what we find is that 18% of our students went on to another experience of 1 year or more. It's hard to figure out how good or bad that is. I just kind of joke around and always say, if I get 18% return on my investments, I'm going to be pretty happy. Okay? But right now, that's about where we are. Actually, I think it's going up a little bit. And what we have done is we went back 2009 to 2014, the last 5 years. And we looked at the long-term mission teams that we have going out that have five-year commitments that are going out for church planting and other types of ministry. So groups going out for 5 years. When we look at those particular groups, we find that 34 out of 51 people were former interns. So 67% of our long-term teams are composed by former interns. However, if you take out the South African going back to South Africa, the Thai girl on the Thai team, and you start removing the foreign nationals and the missionary kids on those teams that had other experiences coming into us, what you find is that almost 80% of our teams come from our short-term mission experiences. So we actually can document that our long-term mission numbers are going up from our short-term mission experiences. And I think one of the reasons that's happened, and you see 2009, 2014, that's when we've been using some of these debriefing techniques. I think the transition there and the increase in long-term missions has been because of the debriefing. So I could say a lot more about other ways that we debrief. We just started a program this past year called Reveal, which is a one-year process. And so our students that come back have the opportunity to join us, five of us that help them in mentoring groups and spiritual discernment groups. We meet weekly for the course of an entire year to help them process what they did and think through about where they're going with what their experiences. And right now we have about half of our interns from this past year that have signed up for the long term. So, short-term missions. I think there's tremendous potential, but I think we've been fooling ourselves for a long time. That most short-term missions do not come with any form of debriefing built in. And the research indicates that if there's not some kind of debriefing built into it, that we're not getting the results that we assume we're actually getting. We're getting shortchanged in the process. There's another step that needs to be involved. If that step is in there, I think then we can look at the research going on and say, hey, there's validity to a short-term mission trip. We're going to start a long-term experiment, research project This doesn't sound good to say I'm experimenting on students, does it? No. Research project starting this next year with our Worldwide Witness students going out. It's going to be a longitudinal study also with control groups. We anticipate, if this goes the way we think it will be, it'll probably be the largest research and one of the longest research projects ever done on short-term missions in history. So we're looking forward to that. It'll start probably this coming summer. So, questions, feedback, thoughts? Where are we here? Yeah.
On your debriefings, is it inconceivable to stop them as soon as they get back and debrief them? Or?
You know, I think in a local church, that's the ideal. I think that there's a couple different ways to do this. There are a few groups that will actually meet you on the field, okay? So in Sandy's case, okay, Sandy here runs one of our internships in Papua New Guinea. We usually send 4 to 5 students with Sandy. Now, when he's with them day in and day out, there is ongoing processing in that internship, which helps tremendously. And then he takes a couple of days in Brisbane when they leave Papua New Guinea, stop in Brisbane on the way back, and it almost serves that same function of helping them process before they get back here. I think if you can do that, that's the ideal. I think if you can do that and put something into their hands that strings out the process over several weeks, even better, or even several months. There have been a couple of churches I've bumped into that what they did was if you signed up for a short-term mission, then you would stay together for a semester when you came back. So let's suppose a group went in the summertime, and then up until Christmas, that same group would meet every week throughout the fall of the year to discuss what they had experienced and work through something like this. So I think it is doable in a church, and I think that is the ideal, to catch people before they jump back in. Good point. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I've got a couple of questions. One is, in a congregational context, would you recommend the Kearney Smith assessment? Is that something that we could give our people that are going on?
Yeah, the Kearney Smith? Yes. There's a couple of things involved in that. It is one of those kind of things you have to kind of get licensed in, but there's several of us up here that are licensed. We could probably partner with you and help you with that, or we could get one of your church members to go through the process and actually become licensed in doing that. I don't know how much that is, Sonny Smith. I'm not too sure. I got licensed several years ago, so I'm not too sure. And it is all online. It's the kind of thing to where we send you a link, you click on it, 15 to 20 minutes is probably about all it takes. But it really, really is valuable. You'll get two or three things off of it. You'll get this bar graph that says overall your experience is, you know, an A+ or a C or whatever. And then they'll take these, it's either 13 or 20 different areas right now, I'm not remembering. And it'll look at your behavior, your own personal evaluation of your personal behavior, your personal beliefs, your organizational experience, your cultural experience, and your relational experiences. And it breaks each one of those down into about 4 or 5 different questions. And then it'll chart that from your highest score to your lowest score. So you get a page that has, you know, things over here that are great, and then trickle down to the left side over here. And usually there's a trend when you get down to that lower scoring stuff. And very often what we find is it really wasn't stuff that happened on the field. But stuff that happened on the field triggered memories and issues that people already had, but they've not dealt with it. But the field brings it up. And then that would allow you as a minister to say, okay, well, let's talk about your family. Let's talk about those behaviors. Let's talk about those issues. So I think it'd be a great opportunity.
The second question I had is, one of the things we try and do is do some debriefing during the mission experience.
Yeah.
So at night, we talk through some of those same questions that you posed in your book. Is that, something that you feel like is helpful, or having the entire experience and then coming back and doing a large?
I think both and, okay? And here's why. The places, we work with 60 different people overseas in Worldwide Witness, and we ask the people that are receiving our interns on the field to give us 5 hours of mentoring per week, and if they don't, basically we cut them from the program. And so 5 hours isn't that huge, but if you think about 2 or 3 meals during the week sitting down together. But typically what will happen is students will live with a missionary, and there's this ongoing processing, or like with Sandy's case, I mean, they're backpacking across Papua New Guinea, and so there's a lot of conversation that happens along the way. So I think that is critical in the moment, and I think if you can do both, it's best. What we did find was that students that had none of that going on and weren't able to process in the moment, and they come back with us. I can point to a lot of those this year that their mentor either didn't do a really good job on the field, or they got split out. There were a couple of times in which they got split, and they would spend 3 days with someone else. And in that 3 or 4 day period of time, they didn't have this ongoing processing. And those are the times that seems like they get jumbled up in their heads as to, how do I interpret this? How do I handle this? What's God doing now? And so I think walking along the way is huge. I mean, if you had one or the other, I would say walk with them along the way. If it's a choice, but if you can do both, because our students have both, and we see a major another step that goes on once they come back and have something.
One thing we've seen with the walking after they get back is some of it is integrating it into their life back
now
in the States.
Right.
So you have that on the field time, but then it's hard for a lot of them to make that connection to day in, day out life. So now that you're back in the rat race, you're back in the school, you can unpack that some when they're back in your element.
How to translate it into life here and now. Yeah, because they can sometimes say, "Oh, in that context, I'm like this," but now we've got a new context. So how do we keep it going? That's a really good point. Other questions? Yeah.
Most of y'all's data and whatnot, does it come from students, or do you get from data from churches too that are sending out small groups, or?
Our worldwide witness data, that last little slide, was just from our students, the 734 students we've sent out from here. Earlier on, when I referred to the qualitative and quantitative studies, that was across the board. That was churches and universities and everything together, sending organizations all together. So that was very, very broad-based. All right, well, if you are a church sending group, I invite you to come on up. I'd love to just put one of these in your hands, let you take it with you. And I'm going to stick around for a few more minutes to answer any kind of questions or visit any kind of ways you guys want. If you're a student, we're going to start recruiting for Worldwide Witness. Probably in the next couple of weeks, you'll start seeing the big W show up in different places around campus. That'll be with me or Larry Henderson. And what we try to do is we try to find out what your passions and your giftedness is and then match that. We find that internships work if you have a good fit for where you're going, if you have someone on the field that will walk with you and help you process along the way. Those tend to be the biggest two things that we need in an internship so that it becomes some kind of a life formative situation. We're typically going to only send you in groups of twos and threes unless we send you to a place where overseas you're going to be working in an orphanage where there's tons and tons of people around, and sometimes we'll go up to about four or five. But typically we're going to send you in groups of twos and threes because otherwise you become gringo land walking around this big ACU bubble and you don't learn anything about the culture. And so I'd love to visit with you guys that are here as students, and I'll hang around for a few more minutes. God bless and thank you very much.